welcome to the Southern Fried Security Podcast. It's episode number 158. I am your host, Joseph Sicoli. I am joined by the illustrious Steve Reagan. Steve, how are you doing?
Greetings. I'm good. It's about to rain here, so I'm watching like the sky turn dark and everything's blowing around outside. It's awesome, actually.
Yeah, Maryland decided that we were going to have a few days of spring and then skip straight into summer. It was like 85 here today. And I kind of want my spring back. Like, I just want a couple more weeks of like 70 degrees. That would be so nice. But what can you do? Missing tonight is Yvette, who is probably somewhere on an airplane. And also, I forgot to mention this last week, but our good friend Andy Willingham had his baby a couple of weeks ago. Well, I guess his wife had his baby.
Yeah, be specific there.
So we do want to offer our congratulations to Andy, which is kind of explaining his absence, obviously. Yeah, so I guess let's go ahead and jump into stories. We've got some fun stuff this week. First things first. Have you heard about the six hacker tribes, Steve?
I have not until you pointed this article out to me. And suddenly I am deathly afraid of white hats. I have this uncontrollable urge to run now. I don't know why.
So this made the rounds, I guess, last week or so. The Telegraph published a story titled Unmasked, the six hacker tribes you need to avoid. And the tagline here is that hackers fall into one of six tribes: secret agents, voyeurs, hacktivists, white hats, glory hunters, and cyber thieves. And I thought it was really nice of them to so succinctly sum up that all hackers fall into these six categories.
I call dibs on secret agent. I'm just saying.
Do you have the bow tie for it?
I do. I have the bow tie. I still have a tux that fits me. It works. But where do we start? So obviously we're joking, but seriously, this article's real. Secret agent is the number one tribe that they talk about. And they break down each tribe into like age demographic, which for secret agent would be young and middle-aged male, which I'm sorry, but I know quite a few women who work in the intelligence space. And anyway, so geographical location would be Camp Williams, Utah, the United Kingdom, Beijing, Russia. Gee, okay. Their motivation is international politics, high-value trade secrets, and intellectual property. Sure. Okay. I really don't even know how to break this down and explain it like news-wise, because I don't understand it. So we're going to go down and we're going to do real life examples of secret agent hacker tribes, and the real life examples listed here. Are you ready? Stuxnet, Sandworm, Rain Malware. So oddly enough, last year at Black Hat, Stuxnet and I sat down and had beers. And because, you know, it's not often you get to mingle with hacker tribes anyway. So I was thinking I may as well buy the guy a beer. And we sat down. It was pretty awesome. For some reason, I couldn't turn my computer off. The fans kept running and running until they got overheated and the computer shut down. So I had to get that replaced. It was weird, but, you know, it was a good meeting. Productive anyway. So I know it's not funny, but just laugh with me. Give me a pity laugh. Come on. So after Secret Agent, we got the Voyeur, and their motivation is sex, sexism, and bragging rights. Their targets are female celebrities and women in general, and of course they are young males who live in the U.S. or Western Europe. So sorry, guys, in Eastern Europe, you don't count anymore. after that, you've got the hacktivists.
Which is notable that the hacktivist is the only category that includes females on the list. The age demographic is young males with a few females who apparently are of indeterminate age. and their real life examples are Anonymous, the Syrian Electronic Army, Lulzsec, and Edward Snowden. And so I was reading this article out loud to my wife over dinner, and she looked at me for a second and went, didn't Edward Snowden like already have access to all that stuff? Did he really have to hack for any of that?
WGIT.
Yeah, WGIT is not a crime. Okay, we're just going to keep moving because otherwise my brain is going to leak out through my ears because this is my favorite one.
My favorite tribe. Yes. Yeah. This is my favorite tribe.
The White Hat tribe.
The best part about this and why it is by far the best tribe ever isn't the demographic. It isn't the age, you know, geographics or anything like that. It's real life examples of white hats. Now, keep in mind, these are white hats that, according to this article, you should be really afraid of. You've got Dan Kaminsky, Alex Holden, wait for it, Andrew Arenheimer, Weave is a white hat. And that is just amazing.
We know that those guys are all, you know, reverse engineering experts, which is one of the things that they talk about as their methods. And also the countermeasures suggested, because they do suggest countermeasures to each of these particular hacker tribes. The countermeasures to the White Hat tribe is rapid response when notified of a bug. All right, I can get behind that. Automated updates. And then you can help this along by having a bug bounty program that gives cash rewards for people who report bugs. So literally the countermeasures, and we're not even going to get into the fact that if you're looking at white hats as a threat actor against your organization, you've already got some serious problems. But their suggested countermeasure is throw money at the problem. It will go away.
Be advised. In the wild, white hat is adverse to money. Show them a large suitcase of cash and they will flee immediately with your cash.
And t-shirts.
Yes, they love t-shirts. Give them a t-shirt and a coffee mug. That usually helps.
All right, and
we got what? Glory Hunter, which Lizard Squad as a Glory Hunter, and ZoneH.org. ZoneH.org is not a Glory Hunter because ZoneH is not a hacker. ZoneH is a website.
The Glory Hunter would like to be a white hat security researcher, but they're not smart enough. I think there's some differing motivations there. And then the last one is, of course, the cyber thief. And what's next will be the rise of the hacker for hire. Okay. This article. Look.
Okay, so I want to clarify this just straight off the bat. The Telegraph got their source. This is the second paragraph of the story. Cybersecurity firm CloudMark has identified 6 different hacker tribes. So Joe and I both went to the CloudMark website and tried to find the source article for this. Or the press release or something. And there's absolutely nothing on there. So I don't know where CloudMark is getting their data from to put this up, but seriously, the secret agent and the cyber thief are pretty much identical, except for the fact that one had the word government involved.
The other one's
otherwise,
money. Yeah.
Yeah. Otherwise, they're exactly the same. But the best part is the end. You know, the rise of hacker for hire. I don't know why they put that in the article, because now that it's out there in the public, people are going to start hiring hackers to do criminal things. Hackers are going to expect, you know, hey, maybe if I sell my botnet to 5 or 6 people, I can make more money on the back end using the same tools. This is horrible. Now that's what we're going to have to face. And responsible disclosure. This is why we need it.
Yeah. And, you know, and the idea of threat actors is not terrible. But just this presentation is...
I'm in tears right now. I'm trying not to laugh and ruin the recording.
Also, it's important to note that they managed to hit like pretty much all of the hacker clip art bingo. You have a guy who seems to be messing with his stereo in the first image. You have the Guy Fawkes mask for the hacktivist. You have hooded guy with lots of ones and zeros for the cyber thief. And then the hacker for hire apparently types with gloves on. Because you can't be too safe.
You can't leave fingerprints on the keyboard. I've seen CSI Cyber. They're going to find that stuff. We're in trouble if we do this.
Okay. Yeah, so read this article for a good laugh. And then please then please put it out of your mind forever. Yeah. So moving right along to something a little more serious and more interesting is that.
Funny.
Yeah. So over the past week, there have been two different stories that came out, kind of regarding security accountability. The first is that at RSA, White Hat, not to be confused with the White Hat hacker tribe, White Hat Security, I guess they're offering kind of a breach insurance. Can you clarify that a little bit, Steve?
So in the show notes, we're going to point you to an article by Gattaca over at Forbes. And I'll read you the last paragraph here. It says, accountability has been a long-standing problem with security. Jeremiah, and that's Jeremiah Grossman at White Hat Security, told me that their company will now start offering clients $250,000 if their website was compromised using an attack that White Hat may have overlooked. Now, that number is up to $500,000. I'd rather enjoy this foray by White Hat into demonstrating accountability. Point being is, White Hat Security sells products that will defend your website against attacks and application attacks. It's a web application firewall. So, they're really good at what they do. Now, they're backing up their technology and their product by saying, if you get owned by something that we overlooked, we're going to pay you for it. I really can't think of anything bad to say about this. I mean, this is literally a company putting their money where their mouth is. And wow, is, you know, when I first heard about this, I honestly thought I'd misheard the two researchers discussing it. And I was like, okay, well, maybe that's not what it is. And then I read the press release and I was like, okay, well, that really is what it is. That's cool. Because, I mean, here's a company that develops a security product that says, if you get owned by this type of attack that we are supposed to protect you from, we're going to pay you.
Yeah. I mean, it's now I noticed on Twitter earlier that Jeremiah said that they have not paid out yet. And I think it will be very interesting because let's face it, there is no perfect security blinky box. Eventually they will pay for something. And I think it will be really interesting to see what happens then. You know, to see this sort of postmortem, because White Hat is a good company, right? They do good by the community. And I think that, not that I want to see them fail by any means. But that I will be really interested to see what happens if, or when they do, see kind of what the breakdown is, and the postmortem on something like that.
You know what? I think it was Sentinel. I think the app, the programmer, the product is called Sentinel. I know this seems really bad for a security reporter to not know the product from a given company he would cover on a day, but trust me, I see so many of them, they blend together after a while. Anyway, I saw White Hat's product in a demo once, and it was really cool because it honestly deflected pretty much every low-level, low-hanging type fruit attack that this guy could come up with. I mean, he's throwing everything at this website, and it's just blocking them all, just by default. You didn't even notice anything was going on, except for the recorded events going, we stopped this, we stopped this. And I thought that was really cool, because 9 times out of 10, when you get owned from a web attack, it's usually something really cheesy, like SQL injection, or, you know, just somebody dumping your database for you. And it... that's how this starts. And so, you know, seeing something like that work, and they're not the only web app firewall on the market. They're not. They're not the only vendor that could protect you against this. But as far as I could tell, they're the only vendor that says, if you get owned by something we should have stopped, we're going to pay you. And that's crazy, actually. Yeah. I mean, honestly, that's crazy. But it's cool at the same time.
It's even more interesting that they have started offering you know, even more. So they are absolutely putting, you know, their money on the line in this sort of thing. Because, you know, $500,000 is not anything to sneeze at for any security vendor to toss out to a client. Now, what is really interesting is that, so that was kind of a private sector thing that has sprung up over the past week or so. But we've also had some movement in the government sector, as far as security accountability goes. And this came out on the 1st, and you, I guess, did you break the story, or you at least covered it?
No, I broke it. The only other coverage on this came from websites regurgitating the press release. I'm the only one that actually covered it. So the Department of Homeland Security has this thing called the Safety Act, and it's confusing. If you actually try to read it at face value, you have to really dig into the rules and the wording to get to the heart of the matter. But last week, FireEye was certified and designated under the Safety Act by the DHS to protect their customers and themselves from lawsuits or claims alleging that the products failed to prevent an act of cyber terrorism. Okay? So there are two products from FireEye that are covered here. So that's the Multi-Vector Virtual Execution Engine and the Dynamic Threat Intelligence Platform. Okay?
Okay.
So if you're a customer of FireEye's with one or both of these products and you get hacked or you get compromised in any way, shape, or form from an act of cyber terrorism, or an act of terrorism, I should say.
Okay.
You're basically shielded from liability. You can't be sued. Nobody could take you to court because this product failed. Now, on one hand, this helps FireEye. They can't be sued because they failed. And on the other hand, it helps their customer because the customer can't be sued either.
Mm-hmm.
So when you look at what this is, the Safety Act, according to the DHS, is something that helps deter manufacturers or sellers of anti-terrorism technologies from developing, commercializing, and deploying technologies that could save lives. So in short, what this is, it's supposed to help companies not go out of business if they're sued. It's almost like a Good Samaritan law. Okay.
So that they were trying, so they can't really be held responsible for.
Exactly.
Okay.
I tried, and therefore nobody can say anything bad about me. So FireEye is now a QATT, Qualified Anti-Terrorism Technology, because they were certified and designated under the Safety Act. What that means is anybody who's been certified or designated, they're eligible for protection under something called the Government Contractor Defense. So it shields them from third-party claims that should the QATT fail to prevent an act of terrorism, they're protected. And this is from the DHS FAQ. The successful assertion of this defense eliminates liability on part of the seller for such claims. Designation is prerequisite for certification. Needless to say, those who work in the security industry and have, you know, a great deal to lose or gain by the Safety Act are very upset about this. And the very first thing I heard was a term I'd never heard applied to InfoSec before. It's called regulatory capture. And this is a classic case of that. So regulatory capture is when a regulatory agency advances the causes of commercial or special interest groups over the public's interest. So in this case, it would be, you know, giving Mandiant, who owns FireEye, special treatment compared to everybody else. So why does Mandiant or FireEye, why do they qualify as, you know, why is this regulatory capture in their case?
Yeah, well, that was definitely the first thing that stuck out to me. Particularly from having done government contracting, where, you know, if you fall on the kind of the approved list, as far as being a vendor, if you fall on the approved list, your sales cycle is pretty drastically shortened because at that point, government agencies are coming straight to you. I don't know. This does definitely seem like a way for FireEye to basically print money, at least because they are the only cybersecurity product on the market that has this designation.
Yep. And so here's the interesting thing. It was suggested that maybe I'm looking at this all wrong and that, you know, it doesn't protect their customers or anything like that. And the truth of the matter is, FireEye states it does protect their customer. They put that out in their press release. But also on their earnings call last week, Dave DeWalt said that beyond the endorsement of our technology by DHS, the certification represents a huge benefit for global enterprise customers and potential savings on both insurance and legal expenses.
Wow.
So, I mean, they know exactly what's going on. And literally, this does. This puts them a step ahead of CrowdStrike, for example.
Right.
Their Parable. It puts them a step ahead of Norse. It'll put them a step ahead of McAfee, of Symantec. And when you look at the list of companies who have been certified under the Safety Act, you know, they're the only pure InfoSec company here. Hmm. They're the only ones. So why hasn't anybody else done this? Why isn't this a goal that all security companies want, especially if you want to do business in the federal, you know, sector? And I can't find answers to that. So I went to FireEye and I said, you know, what's it take to get qualified under this? What steps, hoops did you have to jump through?
Mm-hmm.
And this is not in the story that that we're going to link to you in the show notes. This is actually a bit of an exclusive for the podcast because I haven't written this yet.
Nice.
But their general counsel actually first, their general counsel told me flat out they will not release the actual application to me. That is just information they won't get. So if I'm going to get answers at this point, I need a Freedom of Information Act request sent into DHS. Which, as you and I both know, this takes forever, so this is going to be a long process. But in the meantime, he outlined a lot of things that they had to go through, which is, like the fact that it took them 120 days to have the application approved and everything like that. And the DHS determined whether the application subject matter is useful, effective in deterring, defeating, responding to, mitigating, or otherwise combating security threats like cyber or terrorist attacks. Now, this is interesting. So anyway, this is interesting because notice in the Safety Act and in the wording of their press release that I quoted, the thing is, they're talking about terror threats, right?
Right.
So here's their general counsel telling me, you know, in quote here, you know, in deterring, defeating, responding to, mitigating, or otherwise combating security threats like cyber or terrorist attacks. So now we've got terrorist, cyber terrorism, or just generic cyber attacks.
Oh, now that's interesting.
Ha ha, ha ha. Yeah, so...
So that is a little different. So in your story, you mention a quote by Adrian, I always butcher his last name, Sanabria?
Yeah.
I should really know this. So sorry, buddy. But so he says this quote here that the end result looks like a legal get out of jail free card for businesses that use FireEye. But for that to actually happen, it seems like we'd need a computer related incident or breach to actually be declared a quote official act of terrorism by the U.S. government. So it seems like that doesn't necessarily have to be declared terrorism. You just kind of have to prove that it was.
Well, see, so it's not that you have to prove that it was. It has to be declared terrorism, or you have to get somebody to say, yes, that was a terrorist act. But consider Heartland, consider TJX, consider Anthem, consider Sony. Sony actually led to sanctions being issued against a nation state.
Okay? So that could be easily you could demonstrate that that was an act of terrorism.
Yes. And okay. I have to find her quotes, but those of you who follow me on Twitter, look in my mentions, and you will see a great conversation by Elle Sutton. And she has made a lot of great points over the weekend in discussing this with me. And honestly, she's a genius level at understanding this stuff at this moment because she knows way more about it than I do. And it's led to me doing all kinds of research, which is great. But she actually outlines what terrorism is and what it's under statute. And oddly enough, everything she mentions could be applied to a general cyber attack. Everything.
Wow.
Every bit of it. And so that took me back to Adrian's comment. You know, this is a get out of jail free card, which, again, why isn't everybody doing this then?
So either the barrier of entry is really high on this and it's a time consuming process, but we don't know yet.
All of the times that Mandiant/FireEye has testified in the House and in the Senate and before Congress and the various committees is finally paying off.
Yeah.
Straight up.
And then, that's going to be tough. It doesn't feel good to not necessarily accuse a company of something like that, but it's kind of understand. It is. It's a little disconcerting if they are receiving preferential treatment like that.
The big fear, and everybody I've talked to so far has expressed this in one way or another, is that this stifles innovation. What is there to compete with now? If you're wanting to work in the federal space and FireEye's your approved vendor, that's it. You're done.
Yeah. Oh, that's a good point. Because, yeah, I mean, why would any government organization or really any large organization, why would you go anywhere else if you have a get-out-of-jail-free card?
Or even if you don't have a get-out-of-jail-free card, you could still make a good case because, hey, they're an approved government vendor. You can use this, you know, for insurance purposes and everything else. We're using government contractors for our security. We truly believe that nothing bad would happen here, so we're not at fault.
Yeah, and, you know, this almost seems like a nobody ever got fired for buying IBM. It kind of seems
now
like
nobody ever got fired for buying FireEye. Seriously, exactly. That's exactly what that is. And again, you know, it's so weird. The follow up story, I'll put the notes from the general counsel in, and it's just I don't understand it yet. I'm still trying to figure out how. My big question is where's FireEye's incentive to keep innovating?
Right.
You know, one thing I've always said, I don't agree with everything FireEye puts out, but I will say this, they're a good company. And their researchers are wow. They're really good people. But where's the incentive to keep innovating?
Right.
If you lock up the government sector, you're pretty much set. You really don't need to do anything else.
And especially, you know, from my experience working at a vendor, right, often if you make sweeping changes to a product, you kind of have to you have to go through classification again.
And so I asked,
they may have put Ryan. a five-year hold, because I believe that's what Adrian said it was that this was a 5-year certification.
Yeah, it ends in 2020, April 30th, 2020. So
did they just put a five-year hold on innovation?
No. And I asked this question, what happens if you change the product? And hold on, I've got his comments right here. Finally, with respect to your question about as the product is improved with an updated or a new version and whether those changes are automatically covered under the award, the answer is yes, they are automatically covered with some exceptions.
Wow.
When a company makes a generational change to the product or service, such as a slightly improved hardware updates that it's a software that while improving performance and effectiveness but don't radically change the device or service, those are automatically included. And he goes on to explain why and, you know, things like that. But if you make a revolutionary change to the product, so say you go from gasoline propulsion to an all-electric or form punch card computing to the latest iOS operating system, that revolutionary change will be considered material by DHS and requires you to notify the Safety Act office. Depending on the circumstances of the change, the awardee will either have to modify the award to reflect that change or file a new application.
Huh.
So the key factor, he says, is whether the change is material. So software updates and, you know, basic generational updates and improvements, so version 1 to version 2 to version 3, as long as they're not considered material, you know, punch card to iOS type changes, it's automatically grandfathered in for good or for bad.
Interesting. Huh. That's a lot to chew on. And I think it's going to be interesting to see kind of, depending on what a Freedom of Information Act request turns up, you know, what other vendors need to be looking at as far as getting certified themselves, or if this is kind of a one-off kind of trial thing for the DHS. I don't know. It's definitely going to be interesting going forward. And with that, I think we're out of time. So Steve, if people were looking for your Twitter mentions or you on Twitter, where would they find you?
They would find me on Twitter at SteveD3. And again, Elle Sutton is her name, and she's brilliant. Please read her thoughts on this matter because they add a lot of context to the story. They're worth reading. Also, actually, that entire conversation thread is just a gold mine of smart people. Pay attention to it. It's very valuable.
Right on. And you can find me at Jay Sicoli on Twitter, and you can find the show Twitter at SFS Podcast. Show notes can be found at southernfriedsecurity.com. And I think with that, we'll wrap it up. So good night, buddy.
Good night, guys.